from Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our studios on the campus of UW-La Crosse. Thanks very much for joining us. We're talking today about a couple of organizations in La Crosse that are in the business of being a sort of safe haven, a place where youth and some others can gather, can get a point in the right direction if that's needed, and can kind of get away from some of the troubles that they might experience in other parts of their life. Joining us for this first segment is an organization that I'm very eager to learn more about. It's called The Good Fight, and its founder and its program coordinator are here with us. First, let me introduce the founder and executive director of The Good Fight, Nate Coleman Jr. Nate, thanks a lot for being on Newsmakers today.
Thank you.
Also joining us is Carly Schreiber. Carly is the program coordinator for The Good Fight. Carly, thanks for being here.
Absolutely.
Nate, tell me about how you got the idea to start an organization like The Good Fight.
The Good Fight was kind of, to be perfectly honest, an accident that was born out of necessity. A friend of mine, his daughter, was kind of struggling in school, and I offered boxing as kind of a out for her anxiety and anger and all that kind of stuff. And she started to learn boxing. And then I realized she was behind in school. At the time, I was the coach for the UWL Boxing Club. And so I told the club members who I wasn't charging to coach that the way they would pay me was to tutor this kid. So her grades began to get better, and she was enjoying boxing. Well, one kid turned into two turned into four, and suddenly I have all these kids. And the place where I was at, we were doing a day membership. The guy basically came to me and said, hey, I can't have all these kids running around. So then I decided, well, maybe I needed to find a new space. We ended up finding a spot in the basement of the King and Fifth building. We did some cleaning and helped a guy who was opening a gym down there, and he gave us a space, and we outgrew that space, and we moved to J Street, and then we outgrew that space, and now we're at 118 6th Street North in about a 8,000 square foot building, and we've just grown and grown.
Starting out as just, you know, helping out one friend's daughter, you now offer not only boxing, you've got different kinds of tutoring and all kinds of opportunities for kids to get a little help with school or whatever else is troubling them. A food pantry, all kinds of things going on at The Good Fight. And how long have you been working on all this in La Crosse?
The Good Fight's been open for 5.5 years. We'll August 2nd will be 6 years old.
Carly Schreiber is the program coordinator for The Good Fight. Carly, tell me a little bit about what you haven't been with the organization the whole time, but how long have you been with the organization, and what was your first impression of what all they had going on there when you arrived?
I started at The Good Fight as the program lead in September, and then Nate had asked me to fill the program coordinator role because we really needed one of those, but I was on the fence, didn't know what I was going to do. I was graduating soon, and I decided I was going to do it. So I'll be there after graduation full time too, which is super exciting. I've actually been interested in being involved with The Good Fight for much longer than I've worked there. COVID happened, and that made some setbacks, but I think I was most drawn to working with at-risk youth because there aren't a lot of those smaller, like tighter-knit youth organizations around, and The Good Fight was, so I was really interested for that reason.
Nate, the conspicuous part of the idea, it's part of your logo, it was part of your very first student that you helped. It's all about the boxing, and I know your whole organization isn't all about boxing anymore as you've gotten into so many things. But for people who are less familiar with how boxing works as a sport, it can seem counterintuitive that you're helping people with aggression, with anxiety, with all these things, by teaching them how to fight. Talk about how boxing as a sport and that context of the rules and the strategy and all of that turn out to be a teaching tool.
Listen, a lot of people don't understand that in life, life is kind of a fight. In life, you're going to get punched. You're going to have something that happens to you. You lose a loved one, a relationship breaks up, you lose a job, whatever. And it's not that those things happen. It's how you respond. The same thing in a boxing ring. Boxers may take a hard punch. They go down. You take a deep breath. You get up and you remember, you know what? I came here to win. I came here to be a champion. You put your hands up and you move forward. The concept of learning that you can deal with adversity, the concept of learning that things happen that may be out of your control, they're in your control. It's your reaction to things. So something happens to you. You can get through it. You can respond in a way that shows that you're a champion, that you have a championship heart, that you have a desire to win. And that is a lot of what we teach. A lot of the kids who train and do boxing training never spar, never actually box another person. Many of them are just punching bags or doing mitt work with coaches. But they learn the desire to succeed. They learn how to push through the physical pain of punching when you're tired, of moving forward through something that's difficult. And that's the lesson that most of these kids get. They learn to be a champion. You train like a champion and you become a champion.
When did you first learn about boxing?
When I was a kid and in trouble. there was a young, I guess he was younger then, but he was a school counselor, and he told my mom that he had a after school program. That's all he said. He never told her what it was. And he had a boxing gym. He didn't have all the other things that we've added. It was just literally a boxing gym. And so in going there, it gave me an out, somewhere to be. And he set expectations. And I didn't want to disappoint my coach. I wanted to meet those expectations. I did the things he asked me to do.
You said you were a kid in trouble and you found this boxing. What impact do you think that had on the rest of your path forward?
I think the biggest impact was that I found someone who believed in me and also demanded something from me. He demanded that I show character. He demanded that I do my absolute best.
That's Nate Coleman Jr. He's the founder and executive director of The Good Fight in La Crosse. Joining us also is program director Carly Schreiber. Carly, there are a lot of different opportunities for kids to participate at The Good Fight. Aside from the boxing, which one were you most excited to become involved in?
I wouldn't say at first I was most excited, but now that I am a part of it, our Perfect 10 program for the summer.
Tell me what that is.
It's a program offered for seventh graders going into eighth grade and basically helps catch them up to speed with their vocabulary and math skills to better prepare them for eighth grade. And along the way, we have like fun field trips I got to plan just to add a little fun to their curriculum because wants to be in school in the summer, just kind of gives them an incentive to be involved.
Tell me about a couple of the other non-boxing sort of resources. I see artist workshops listed among your offerings. What goes on at a Good Fight artist workshop?
Yeah, so we have Viterbo Art Education come in once a week, and they come in for an hour and do an art project with our kids. So we've done stuff like tie-dye. We've done like clay molding and we've done canvas painting, a bunch of stuff like that.
Nate, when you started this, I know you said this grew way beyond what you originally intended. In the back of your mind or like in your vision for this part of your life, did you envision being the executive director of a youth services organization like this?
No. but I have cherish the role. I found my calling. It took me, I guess, a good portion of my life. But the thing that has happened is that as we've grown because the need has grown, there's so many kids and so many things that kids need We have partnered with La Crosse School District as well as La Crosse County. We do work with Juvenile Detention Center. All of these different community organizations, we've just figured out that we see the same group of kids. Let's all work together to start finding a success for these kids. In talking about, for example, Perfect 10, I was at a conference where they said 36% of eighth graders graduating have a sixth grade reading and math level. So I thought we need to catch them before they go into eighth grade to give them a fighting chance in eighth grade so that when they test and when they graduate, they have a shot at high school, at doing well in high school. If we can take that part of it off the table where kids feel confident going into high school, we got a shot at sending them to college or at least when they get into the job field, they have some confidence that they can succeed.
Carly, tell me about some of the particulars. How old do kids have to be to participate in programs at the Good Fight?
So the ages are 10 to 18, and we mostly see a higher number of middle schoolers.
And so when families called to sign up, what are the expenses that they could expect to face?
It's $25 for a monthly membership, and that includes everything we offer. We don't expect any payments outside of that. Everything we have to offer is free to our members.
And where can people find out more? What's the website, or what's a good phone number for them to call?
The website is thegoodfight.club, and our phone number is 608-518-3301, and we also have enrollment forms on our website. Otherwise, you can always feel free to stop in and grab one too.
Okay, and it's on 6th Street in La Crosse and online at thegoodfight.club.
Yep.
In terms of the community reaching out to you, are there ways that the community can help out? Do you look for volunteers? I know everybody's always looking for funding as well.
On our website, there is an area for volunteers. Carly came in and cleaned that whole thing up, so the process now is much easier if you want to volunteer. The form is right there. It's really easy to fill out, and we're in contact with you within 48 hours of the time that you fill that out. As far as funding, one of the challenges of being the little guy, so to speak, in town is that I don't have a staff that's writing grants. Fundraising and donors are very important to us to fill our budget and to make sure that we can take care of kids here. And while it is $25 a month, that should not be a discouragement. We do have scholarships. As long as we can turn on the lights and open the doors, we welcome kids here. So that shouldn't be a barrier either. You know, if a parent says, you know, I can't pay $25, still send your kid. We want to do what we can to help those kids.
That's Nate Coleman Jr. He's a founder and executive director of The Good Fight, which is an organization on 6th Street here in La Crosse and online at thegoodfight.club. Nate, thanks a lot for joining us on Newsmakers today.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. I really appreciate you.
Yes, sir. Carly Schreiber is the program director for The Good Fight. Carly, thank you for being here as well.
Yes, thanks for having us.
This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. As I said earlier, we're talking today about organizations that provide a safe haven for youth in our community. One of those that does not do so through membership, but does so in another way, is The Warehouse, which is an all-ages alcohol and drug-free concert venue downtown. And we will talk to its founder after this. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our La Crosse studio, and I'm pleased to be joined by two folks from a place downtown in La Crosse called The Warehouse. We're talking today about different ways that a couple of our local organizations are offering space for youth and other young people to be themselves, to make it through some of life's challenges, and just have a safe place of positive influence. And I cannot think of a better example of that than the Warehouse here in our community. Steve Harm is the founder and the manager of the Warehouse, and he's the what did you say, Steve? Non-voting executive director of the Warehouse Alliance, which is the nonprofit board that oversees the Warehouse. And a board member of that group is with us here as well. And it's Ben Cook, who's also a member of the Sweat Boys band, which I'm very pleased to have butchered the name of. Ben and Steve, welcome to Newsmakers.
Happy to be here.
How you doing?
Doing well, thank you very much. So let's get right into the history of the Warehouse, Steve. This thing has been around at least since I was a kid. 30 years now? 30 plus years even?
We're on our 31st year right now.
Tell me how you got the idea to get it started.
I'd been in a band that toured up until about 89, and when we stopped doing that, I got a job with the sound company and traveled around doing that. And when I had time off, I would hang out at some friend's place, and it was a tanning salon in the basement of this building. Some buddies had a salon down there. We're on the corner of 4th and Pearl downtown in the historic district, old historic building. At that point, the building was in terrible shape, and there was nothing on the first floor, second floor, or third floor, but the guys had keys to it, and one day I took their keys and came upstairs and looked around, and forgetting the 49 stairs I just walked up, I looked at the big room on the top and went, wow, we could put on shows here. But what we ended up doing was we opened a place that was open from 10 p.m. until 4 a.m., not for kids, it was for 18 up. And we played all kinds of European import music that nobody else was playing. It was cool, but you should never have a venue open that late in a town that is built on binge drinking. Because at 2:30, when normal people go home, the people that don't go home are the ones that are too drunk to know that they should go home. So that didn't last very long.
When did you sort of mentally make the switch and get the idea that you were going to create like more of a concert space and go sort of the all-ages route?
The five of us closed it after about 6 months and talked to the landlords, had an idea that we could probably open a place for teenagers that would have dance music. And so it was about 6 months after that we got it going. We had been kind of tricked by the landlords. They said, sure, you can do that. We'll rent it to you cheap. All you have to do is bring it up to code. We didn't know what that meant. but we did end up getting it going up to code. My buddy's father was an architect. And so he helped a lot with that. And we had just teen dance nights for the first probably year. And that was on weekends and did real well because kids of all types need places to go, you know, where they can be themselves. And so we took all the money that we made every weekend and put it into getting the building up to code. And then it was going to be eventually the landlords decided to sell it because we got it up to a nice enough condition where they could sell it. Long story short, a bunch of kids wrote a letter to a local paper saying that we were really trying to get financing, and a local bank came through for us. And then the partner that I was in it with bailed, so it was just me having to sign the paperwork, and here I was with the building downtown with not really any idea what to do with it. It was vacant. I kept doing the teen dance nights, but I was bothered by bands every week coming in saying, hey, we'd like to play here. And so eventually we did, after probably about a year and a half then, I guess that was. And that happened to be at the perfect time when grunge bands were getting big out in Seattle. A lot of them had to drive to New York to showcase for record labels, and that routes them right through La Crosse. And if they wanted to play one stop on the way to New York, halfway there, just to keep their chops before they got to New York, they'd want to do it somewhere in the Midwest. And La Crosse was easy because it wasn't the pressure of Chicago. So we ended up with all kinds of great bands coming through that just eventually put us on the map and started getting bands to route through on a very, very regular basis.
So the kids here in town got a chance to see some good acts, and some of those acts that have played at the Warehouse have gone on to fame and fortune, or at least fame anyway.
Yeah, that's very true. I mean, 31 years, you see a lot of bands, and we've had bands, we see them on the way up, we see them on the way down, and we see some only once, as they do tend to get way up to the top and stay there, like Fall Out Boy. My Chemical Romance, The Descendants played here, Everclear.
That's Steve Harm from The Warehouse in downtown La Crosse. Ben Cook is with us as well, who's a board member for the Warehouse Alliance. Ben, you are not just a board member, but you were a Warehouse kid way back when. Tell me how you first got introduced to the place.
At the time, some kids who are now in their late 40s with children who are in college, I went to a church youth group thing for a bit, like 92-ish. 92, 93. And one of the dudes who, I think he was like 18, 19, played bass in this band. And him and his girlfriend invited me to come to the show. And that was it, man. I was all in. I was sold. I was a weird kid. Shout out to other weird kids. The bottom line is that it has always been a place where people of any age can show up and be in an environment where people care about the same things that they do. And that was it. That was the big selling point. It was like, you know, I was, as a kid, I was into, just kind of just weird stuff that maybe like other kids weren't necessarily into. And then here's this place where there are all these other people who have similar interests. I was always a music guy, but not everybody gets the interest at home or at school or other places where they spend, you know, a lot of time in their lives. And I'm rambling a little bit here. But sorry. Well, about
I think one of the points that Ben was trying to make is that the whole essence of the Warehouse has always been social misfits can come here, and eventually they will find somebody just like them.
What was it like for you, Ben, to know that there was a place where you could sort of let yourself be yourself and kind of go after some of those, as you said, some of those weird interests or some of those musical interests or whatever that other people might not get, but in an environment that was safe and that you knew you weren't going to do anything that might really get you into any real trouble?
Junior high into high school, even if you are one of the cool kids, sucks. It's hard. It's everything feels huge and permanent and not great. And if you are a square peg that does not fit in that round hole, like it's rough.
One of the unique characteristics of your outfit, as opposed to a lot of the other places that are downtown, is that there's this great music going on, tons of people coming and going, but no alcohol. Well, there's lots of drinks, but no alcohol. So tell me, Steve, how is that important to your design of the kind of space that you're trying to create?
Very much so. La Crosse has a rich history of brewing and drinking, and yeah, that's understandable. We're right down here in the middle of it, downtown. You know, it's a bar every other building. In a town like that, without an all-ages venue, it just seems like a terrible thing that kids would have nowhere to go.
It must be over 30 years worth of kids having a safe space to go, you know, let their hair down, so to speak, on the weekends and even some weeknights, without the constant pressure of, are you going to drink or are you not going to drink? Are you going to do drugs? Are you not going to do drugs? Because that kind of stuff just isn't there.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive, too, to watch the kids who are regulars because, you know, not that we ever have any problems, but kids that come here all the time become our security. If we have a big show and there's kids here from outside the area and anybody is doing anything from even smoking a cigarette somewhere, kids will come get us right away and tell us because they don't want us to lose our license or to have any other issues. The group of kids that are here now, the 100 or so regulars, you know, mixed in with the other kids, they don't seem to have any interest in alcohol, which blows my mind. I was a teenager. Holy smokes. I was some trouble. But these kids are here because they love the music or they want to play music. They want to watch the music. They want to be with their friends, and they don't want to screw it up by drinking.
An organization like yours that is based on gathering and based on live performances and everything, you guys shut down for a good long while. And I know, Steve, that you were you were committed to not only delaying reopening until it was legally permissible, but actually delaying reopening until after a vaccine was available and after it was available to a wide range of people. Tell me about that thought process. What did you experience when you knew you were going to have to shut the place down? And were you ever thinking of, like, are we ever going to be able to reopen?
When COVID came on, nobody thought it was going to last that long, because we'd never dealt with anything like that. At least not our generation had never dealt with anything like that. We had seen it coming because South by Southwest had canceled, and that's a $400 million hit to the city of Austin, which surely wasn't made without a lot of thinking. And in fact, Ben's band was the last band that played before we closed down.
Oh, I forgot that.
Yep, right in the middle of March in 2020?
Yeah, 17th March.
Yep. And, so we thought we'd be closed for a month or 2 months. We'd get some cleaning done. We'd get a few things taken care of that we didn't have time to, and didn't work out that way. And when we saw restaurants opening back up and bars opening back up at the end of May, when the Tavern League had pushed the governor for that, the health people were saying that's a bad idea. So we kind of sat on it for a while because, restaurants have a lot of people, bars have a lot of people, but what we've got here is primarily kids 13 to maybe 18. So they're younger. So they're probably living with older people, perhaps living with parents and grandparents. It didn't seem to us like you want to take those kids. And they were talking about spacing people 6 feet away at some venues at that point. You can't do that at a rock concert, and especially with kids. They come in, all they want to do is pack up to the front of the stage and be as close to that band, without being in it as possible. So we just kept it closed. We kept watching everything, and it just dragged on and dragged on and dragged on. I think that it was 17 months that we were closed until we felt that we should open back up. And that was July of 2021. It was a long, long wait, and we didn't know if we were going to make it through, but we did have some people that donated some money that helped. We got a little bit from the government. We're not a big operation, so we didn't get the millions that a lot of people did, but it wasn't about that. It was about keeping those kids safe, their parents safe, their grandparents safe, because we're a very generational place, so we're very in tune with the fact that, their families are generations. Because we'll get Tommy, the 17-year-old, this week, and 2 years from now, his 15-year-old brother is coming, and you know how that goes.
So, looking forward, I don't know, crystal ball, I guess. What's it like now being back open and looking ahead to the upcoming summer season, where there's a lot of kids outdoors and milling about around town trying to find something to do? What's this season looking like for you, Steve?
Well, we do have shows booked out until September right now. Not thick, but they are coming around. Shows get booked oftentimes 6-7 months in advance, so it's been complicated because bands have been deciding whether or not they want to tour. Agents have been deciding whether or not they want to put those bands out there. And then with some of the tours, they get started and somebody gets COVID and the tour gets wiped out. So I think it's still going to be a challenge through the summer, but we're getting some great shows booked, so we're very much looking forward to it. And the great thing here is, we can throw open a couple windows if we need to, so we're not, it's not like you're trapped in some kind of petri dish of COVID.
So where can people find more information about either the Warehouse and upcoming shows or the Warehouse Alliance and how they can support the organization, Steve?
I believe there's information on all of that at our website that we've been working on, whrocks.com. That's whrocks.com. And there's information on how to help us financially. There's a history of the Warehouse. There's a history of the building. There's all about the Alliance. We're also always looking for volunteers to help out at shows and to help out when we're doing other work around here when the shows aren't going. So there's lots of information there.
Wonderful. Steve Harm is the founder and manager of the Warehouse. And Ben Cook is a member of the board for the Warehouse Alliance, which is the nonprofit organization that helps to run the warehouse. Ben, Steve, thank you very much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having us, man.
Glad to join you.
This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall. If you'd like to get in touch with the program, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is newsmakers@wpr.org. That's newsmakers@wpr.org. Coming up, how about a little bit of music? A brand new piece that was premiered by the choir and percussion ensemble at the University of Wisconsin Superior. That's coming up next, right here on Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our Southwest studios. Eastern Europe has been at the top of the news ever since Russian invasion of Ukraine, and the world is on edge over the possibility of war spreading to neighboring countries. But in a more hopeful note from that part of the world, the University of Wisconsin Superior Music Department performed the world premiere of Stella Teagarden. It's a piece for choir and percussion by Estonian composer Urmas Sisak. From Simply Superior, WPR's Robin Washington was joined by Brett Jones, professor of music at UWS and head of the percussion department. Jones talks about how his department built a relationship with composer Sisak.
In May of 2019, our band took a trip to Estonia, and in preparations for that, when we were choosing musical numbers, there was an Estonian composer that I really admired and had played some of his works and listened to a lot of his works, Urmas Sisak. And I thought that would be the perfect excuse to reach out to him and see if he'd be interested in ever being open to having a piece commissioned. So I made contact with him at that point, and though I didn't get to meet him while we were there in Estonia, it really opened up a door for this commission and him writing this kind of unique work for choir and percussion ensemble.
Mm-hmm. And I guess I have to go back even further in the background on this. Why Estonia? What if you threw a dart at the map, is that how you got there, or was there a particular connection?
Sure. So Estonia is actually home to a really fascinating musical, especially choral tradition. And there was during what was called the Singing Revolution in the 1990s in Estonia and Latvia, groups of people would sing folk songs, nationalistic folk songs, which were actually banned at the time. And that whole movement helped lead to the freedom of Estonia and Latvia and the fall of the Soviet Union.
Right. We should do a little refresher of history that the three Baltic states, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, were part of the Soviet Union from, the end of World War II, I guess, until, as you said, the fall of the Soviet Union. Very similar to Ukraine and, like Ukraine, sharing common borders with Russia. So tell us about the composer.
Sure. He's a really fascinating composer. He's a kind of a minimalist composer, which means he takes a small amount of musical materials and kind of works with them and manipulates them. In a lot of the ways, though, he's a more approachable sort of minimalist composer than others, and writes very tonal music, so kind of music that we're used to listening to. He likes to blend religious music, oftentimes in Latin with Latin texts, with this kind of fascination that he has with astronomy. So many of his pieces point us outward to the stars and galaxies. And I think this piece in particular, he does a spectacular job of that, utilizing this Estonian poetry, religious poetry, but kind of translating that into Latin and then tying that to one specific star. Now, in 2019, when we commissioned this work, there was a discovery made by astronomers of two Earth-like planets that were discovered around the star Teagarden. So Stella is Latin for star, Stella Teagarden. Then we believe that he was kind of focused on that news item in 2019 and then basically wrote this piece around that one particular star. And when he does that, he does the astronomical calculations and basically reduces those down into musical intervals. and then create scales and melodies based on those sort of reduced ratios.
We are talking about the performance of the world premiere, I should say, of Stella Teagarden, a work by Irma Siskas, given by the UWS Choral Ensemble and Percussion Department members. We're speaking with Brett Jones, professor of music at the University of Wisconsin-Superior. So, Brett Jones, we're going to hear the entire piece. Can you, I always say this to our popular music performers that we normally have on the show who have 3 or 4 minute songs, set it up for us. So this might take a little bit of setting up, but set it up for us. Tell us what we're going to hear.
Sure. So first of all, I think just looking at the text to kind of set the stage, the piece Stella Teagarden is based on a poem by Uku Masin, who's an Estonian religious philosopher and poet. And the English translation of the text is, "We see, now we see, this small speckle on this cold night. And we are not cold because we see. Oh my God, would that I might now be able within myself to tell all things that this glimmer has known. Alleluia, the Tea Garden star, thanks be to God."
And here in its entirety is the world premiere of Irma Siskas' Stella Teagarden, performed by the University of Wisconsin-Superior's Choir and Percussion Ensemble, Michael Fuchs, Choir Director, and Brett Jones, Percussion Director, at the Thorpe Langley Auditorium on March 10th, 2022.
Thank you.
That was, in its entirety, the world premiere performance of Stella Teagarden by Urmass Sisak, performed by the University of Wisconsin-Superior Choir and Percussion Ensemble under the direction of Professor Brett Jones. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's how you can listen to our program every week. We're on Friday mornings at 10 on the Ideas Network 90.3 and Friday night at 7 on NPR News and Music 88.9. And we're always online at WPR.org/newsmakers. For producer Dawn Jewell, I'm Ezra Wall. Join us again next time for another Newsmakers right here on Wisconsin Public Radio.